to start, we should probably just maybe just do a small introduction of who you are and what you've done so people know all of the cool stuff you've done.
Whatever limited cool stuff there was. Well, I've gone by an awful lot of names over the years. Back to 96 was when I was still using Shadow. And then from about 2000-ish, it's always been D-Boy or D or something like that. Boy, where do I go from here? That's an awful lot of years.
maybe just start with how you sort of got into translating.
Sure. Okay, that works. I remember probably in about the summer of 96 was when, maybe it was like 95-ish, I'd seen some emulator stuff shoot by in different like software mass mailings and stuff. And around 96 was when I started looking into it a bit more. And back to that time, the main websites for that were, you had Damage Cybernetics, which was run by Mindrape. And they had lots of different sections on it. The two main ones that I visited most often, they had, I think it was Console Heaven or something like that. And that was a section that was mostly focused on console copiers. They even had the directions from Disc Dude's old, I think he had a Super Nintendo dumping thing that I never managed to build. But that's because I was a 14-year-old kid who knew nothing about that. I remember Dave Pavlicek said he managed to actually build it and it worked, but... Well, he could do that because he was a college student doing EE at the time. So, the other section was Archaic Ruins. Archaic Ruins was run by a guy named Chris Hitman. He went by the name Typhoon Z on IRC. And that whole community, as I understand it, was mostly held together around the EMU channel on FNET. And one of the guys in that channel was EFX. And for a while... I wouldn't say it's quite accurate in retrospect, but at the time he was being credited with having done the first ROM hack, which was basically opening up a CHR ROM from a Nintendo game and screwing with the graphics and spitting it back out. And two of the other guys in the channel were Demi, who you are probably familiar with,
yep.
And SOM2 Freak, who... really vanished off the map sometime before 2000. They kind of got, as I understand it, I mean, I wasn't present when this conversation happened, but I only know this from hindsight. You know, I came a couple months after that, but basically they kind of saw the potential of taking what EFX had done and then also hacking the program ROM, and that would make it possible to do some kind of translation stuff. And on Archaic Ruins, they had a section in that site that was called Pina Consolata, and there were only ever three projects that I remember actually appearing on there. There was the Final Fantasy II translation, which I don't recall getting released until the late 90s, the Final Fantasy III translation, which I don't recall actually getting completed by that team, and Yoshi's Super Kid Icarus, which... Hey, you, Jeremy, if you're listening, I'm still waiting, man. I want to play that game. And those were basically the three things they had on there. There were no downloads for anything, but there was some contact information. And in the fall of 96, I had emailed SOM2 Freak, I think, and said that I said, hey, this sounds like something really cool. I'd like to learn a bit about it and try to work on Final Fantasy V. And he got back to me, I think, a little while later, and he sent me a table for the game, and I think he sent me XLate 1.0, which was the worst piece of shit program I've ever seen in my life. I couldn't believe that those guys were actually using it. I had better luck just using Hex Workshop and memorizing the fucking table. And the other... one was a really primitive version of Xcare, which was XLate and Xcare were both by Big Weird. He was an old Parodius guy. And that's kind of said, just got to work on it. I figured, you know, it would have been a good game to do because there was already a script translation out. Back on the, this is going way back into ancient history here, but I think it was Andrew Vestal and Andrew Kaufman. They ran a site called the Unofficial Squaresoft homepage, which later turned into RPG Fan. And on that, they had the complete text translation of Final Fantasy V that some people had done. And it seemed like a good idea to say, okay, well, you know, knowing nothing and approaching, not knowing the way we do this now, where we dump and insert something, you know, we hadn't even thought of doing things that way at that time. And we were just like, well, you find a line in the game, you find the line that matches in the thing, you type it in and go. And so I worked on it a little bit on my own, and I had a little Dragonfire page up that showed some of the work off. Nothing really important. And sometime after Christmas, I think it would have been either late January or February, I'd gotten contacted by a gentleman named Dave Pavlicek. And he was interested in helping out. You know, he was a college guy. College kids have lots of time, as everybody knows. And he was in a Japanese class, too, which, hey, that's a big boom because there's, you know, no one. I'm sitting here with a dictionary back to that time. I barely knew anything. And so he would started, you know, finishing through the enemy names and item tables and all kinds of stuff like that. And I think we picked up another guy by the name of Ben Roth. He was using the handle Thermopile. And after that one, oh boy, Magitech KN came in a bit later, I think. But the next thing that happened was there was this, you know, we had been doing our own thing, releasing the little patches on the site. Like every couple weeks, we had a new little IPS file up. And suddenly, I got this email that was just mind-blowing. Because you got to understand, at this time, I was kind of just like on the corner of the web doing my own thing. I had no real experience with the scene type stuff. I had never really met any of these guys before. And I got this email from Brad Levikoff, the guy who ran Zophar's domain. And he's just like saying, I am so ashamed at you, and you are, you know, you are a real son of a bitch or whatever, and I demand you come to my forum and explain yourself for stealing David Timko's Final Fantasy V translation. And I was sitting there scratching my head wondering, who the fuck is David Timko? And so I go there, and it's just like, you know, absolute insanity. As well, it's exactly what you expect when you have a threaded message board system in World Wide Web 1.0 filled by angry teenagers who don't have cars and don't have girlfriends and have too much time on their hands. I mean, it was just crazy. And so, I mean, there was this big spat, and there was supposed to be some kind of big competition or whatever to see who could finish it first. And the reality is we were both kind of looking at the work we got done. It's like, oh, fuck, I'm not going to finish this anytime soon. And we kind of put our differences aside and all got together on an IRC channel. And I hopped over to EICN's EMU channel, where I hung out with Nailbomb and Corpse and Valus and some of the other Aussies. There was a big channel for them. And it was like, you know, trying to bounce ideas. You know, we're doing a group thing. What do we call ourselves? And it's like, well, we're doing English versions of RPGs. So it ended up being RPGE. And so we made like a little announcement, and there was a big deal where Timko and I tried to put our respective patches together, which, not truly understanding IPS technology very well, that turned out to be a very bad idea. It kind of broke the game badly in many places that we could never track or find out, because frankly, the way we were doing everything up to that time, because none of us thought to say, hey, we should program some tools to just pull everything out and put everything in, it was just bust open a hex editor, you got the table memorized, just pound it out in hex and keep on going. So we'd keep our work in sync. Yeah, well, I mean, we'd keep our work in sync by it's like, oh, here's the part I got done last night. Let me send you an IPS file. Oh, cool. I'll add it to the main patch. And we were just kept tacking all these IPS files on, and it was, you know, it made it impossible to track who the hell introduced a bug, where was the bug at, how are we ever going to fix it. This is in the days when, I mean, emulators didn't even have debuggers. I think the shit we were running back to that time, you had Virtual Super Magicom, which actually was basically its own OS. You had to boot into the damn thing. And it only ran in like 16 colors. It made Super Nintendo games look like a Game Boy. And then there was Super Pacifami. And that one was always... It was actually... At least on my shitty little Pentium 90, it was the best of the bunch. You'd turn it up, and the game kind of ran at like a 40 to 45% speed. But the rest of your desktop all turned kind of like desaturated. It was all black and white. The only color was in the Super Pacifami window.
Interesting.
And then I think the only other thing we had at the time was SNES. And that one was similar. It was another DOS-based one. Later on in the era, there was SNES 96 and SNES 97, and 96 got the sound first, and they tried to merge the projects, and that's where SNES 9X came out of and all that stuff. And anyway, we were like, okay, we got a bunch of people here now, and it's getting insane to try and send patches back and forth, and we'd like to work on some other stuff, too. When we were first starting out, we had run across these guys. They were like the only other site we could find related to translation, because this is in the days of you had like Lycos, you had InfoSeek, and you had WebCrawler. Yahoo, it was then, is now, and always has been a piece of shit for finding web pages. But those three were basically your search engines, and if it didn't come up when you searched there, for all you knew, it didn't exist on the internet. So there was these two guys, I don't remember where they were from, by the names of Quatch and Lord Pinto, and they were working on Dragon Quest 1 and 2, as far as I know. But they'd never released anything, they'd never done anything, their page hadn't been updated since like November of 1996, and all they had was that, and they had this thing called SNES Tile Editor, which was pretty bitchin' because it was the only tile editor that actually ran in a window. Everything else still required DOS. But anyway, we said, well, they're not doing anything with this game. Why don't we do something with it? And that's how we picked up the Dragon Quest 1 and 2, which I want to say Magitech KN was one of the main ones working on that. Then we'd kind of branched out, and we had been doing a little bit of work on the Ranma 1/2 RPG. That's when things just started going in every direction. SOM2 Freak came back. He wanted to help us out, and he brought in Barrowberry, who I think these days he's going by the handle Myria. And he was, like, back to that time, the man for 65CA16 Assembler. And those two guys basically took over the Final Fantasy V translation, and we kind of moved on to other stuff because they were like, you know, we got it. We can handle it. Though SOM2 Freak kind of had this problem of his translations were always... I guess he was like an anime fanboy before there were anime fanboys. I mean, because it was like everything, man. Anything he could nitpick, he'd nitpick stuff, and like he'd go into the Japanese channel and talk to the people in the Japan channel and ask for their opinion on stuff, and the Japanese people kind of looked at him like, just this guy's crazy. No one nitpicks about this kind of stuff, even in the native language. And so his dialogue was kind of a little off, and he kept wanting to hold it back and hold it back and hold it back and hold it back. And the only reason the game finally got out the door was because he had brought on a guy who was using the handle Harmony 7, and I think everyone called him Katz. I think his name was Katsuyuki, and he was helping out with a lot of the translation stuff, and finally he was just saying he wanted it out the door, and that was just kind of it. I think they released it onto a news server or something like that. And SOM2 Freak kind of blew a gasket. And drama, 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 drama. You know, the same stuff that's been in the scene since the beginning. Was then, is now, ever shall be. Amen.
Yes. Always a good amount of fighting going on about whose patches, yeah, and whose translations and whose words and letters and numbers. And
and really, at the end of the day, it doesn't fucking matter to anybody except the two people about it.
So,
I was hanging out and kind of still doing that through about 98, and then I blew a gasket and took off. I think it was 97, I kind of flipped out and took off. Left RPG, left those guys to do their own thing, and I did my own thing for a couple months before just kind of vanishing until, like, 2000.
To write a passage to flip out?
Yeah. I didn't spend 3 years writing a flip-out message. That was just bang, bang, bang on the keyboard, send it out, and then wake up the next day saying, what the fuck did I do? And is how those things are always written. And so I came back in around 2000, and that's when I started saying, you know, everyone's, oh, wow, we've got ZNES and ZSNES, we've got debuggers and all this neat shit now. And boy, the old way of doing things isn't really that interesting anymore. And I started playing with some other stuff. I said, okay, well, it looks like, I mean, at 2000, I was already looking around and saying, okay, they're really running out of games worth translating because, goddamn, man, everything's Super Nintendo, Super Nintendo, Super Nintendo, 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 Nintendo. No one touched any other goddamn thing. I think you had Adelon's group was supposed to be working on Surging Aura. Hi, Adelon. I'm still waiting for the English release of that. It's only been 16, 17 years now. And they ended up doing, like, breaking away from that, and they started doing that thing that was then called the Tavern RPG, which eventually turned into Team Watermelon and Pure Solar. So that's where those guys went. And so I started trying to say, well, you know, at the time, Japanese PC software was just starting to get pirated a whole lot. You were getting easier access to stuff like the Windows ports of Ease and a lot of visual novels and things like that. And then I tried to say, okay, let's play with some of this stuff because no one else is touching it. And I kind of worked on a couple games and it didn't go anywhere. And but what was happening at the same time was I had kind of gotten interested in Langrisser stuff. And I had thrown together kind of a crappy page. The place to go at the time was a site called Langrisser Memorial, run by a guy named Alimony. It was hosted, I think, originally on, like, Escobol's web server or something, and then Zophar's domain picked him up, and then Zophar unceremoniously booted him off the thing. And basically, the Langrisser community was kind of left with nowhere to go. And it just kind of ended up working out where Moon Knight, who had been kind of picking up the drop Der Langrisser translation with Alimony's tools, ended up at my web forum, and then more people came in, so he said, okay, let's do a Langrisser site. I just kind of gave him space to keep doing his thing, and I didn't have anything to do with that. I was kind of doing my own thing at the time. And then he kind of had an incident where he lost everything on his machine, and somehow it ended up where I had the only copy of all the work that had ever been done. I mean, I had the tools, I had all kinds of other stuff, and it was sitting there. And I said, well, I'll hold it for you till you get back. And he didn't really get back. Not for a while, anyway. And he just said, well, you know, you start working on it. And so I did, and we were going at that for a while, looking at how awful all the tools were. Alimony wrote the whole thing in Pascal. He had this crazy font editor where, like, he didn't actually crack the compression. He basically just, like, nulled out the byte that says that the rest next couple bytes are going to be compressed, so the his, like, 8x8 font turned into this crazy, like, 8x6 font. And he had this goofy DOS editor where you'd use arrow keys and whack the space bar to say where you want to draw a pixel or whatever. And we tried to work with that, and it just wasn't working. And I had known Bew from way back in the day, and he kind of popped back up with his Dragon Quest V translation, and he and I got back in touch, got to be pretty good friends, and I said, hey, do you want to help us out with this? And I said, I mean, you know your shit with the assembler stuff, and I don't know my shit with that, and but I could do the translation part. And he said, sure. So he and I were working on that for a while, and a while turned into, I think we spent all together about 7 years on that, because eventually I realized that a lot of the stuff Alimony had translated and stuff was so off the wall that we just had to throw it out and redo it. And, you know, the script was...
The script is huge, yes.
It was big, yeah. It's a Languisher script. Anyone who's worked on a Languisher script knows what I'm talking about. And I'm honestly amazed that Kill managed to get through Languisher 4, because Languisher 4's script was even bigger. But the real pain in the butt was the writing style. They didn't, at that time, I mean, the writing was a little bit simpler compared to the later Languisher games, and they didn't give you a whole lot of clues as far as who was speaking. And the script did nothing to store that. In fact, it's only like, I think 4 years ago, before 5 years ago, we were working on another project and finally managed to reverse engineer the scenario script format, where you actually, instead of dumping the script from the script, you dump the script from the scenario script, and that would at least give you the clue of what name went with it or what portrait, and you could kind of pull that out as some metadata and kind of figure, oh, that's who it's supposed to be saying that, because to this day, there's still lines we've never managed to see in the game. I don't know if the event even exists in there or not.
So there's just lines in there that may not have
no one's ever managed to trigger. Dude, when we released that patch, when we were doing the beta, we spent some time hacking at it. I managed to figure out a lot of the way that the data was structured in there. And we wrote some simple codes that would basically let you move to any tile instantly. I mean, there's a debug code where you can keep removing your guy and stuff like that. But
yeah,
this would just let you literally teleport to anywhere on the map. And you could attack any tile, and you could even attack dead people, just to try and trigger any crazy thing that could possibly happen. And we still had stuff that no one ever managed to see.
Wow.
And that was with what? We had, I think, 20 people doing beta testing on that, and in the years since, still no one's ever actually seen any of that.
So... How did a project that sort of started as something that you just kind of met up with a person who knew a bunch of assembly and started working together become a 7-year ongoing project? Was it just something you were that passionate about, or was it just something you had
to finish? Well, it gets to a certain point. Well, yeah, okay, there were a couple things going on here, which is one is that we kind of felt like it would be a shame to not get it done. And after you've invested a certain amount of time in it, you really want to see it finished. And, I mean, the thing is, too, with a project that time, I mean, it ended up being like Duke Nukem Forever, because you'd work on it for 3 years, and then you find out, oh, shit, everything we were doing is the wrong way. We should fix this. We can make this better. And you rewrite all the work you were doing. The only thing that ever got totally redone was the script, basically, which, except for the... You know, the 20 or 30 files I threw out and redid, but that was a one-time thing. We didn't go back and keep retranslating the script. That would have been too crazy. I don't know what else to say about it. I mean, it's you put enough time into something and you don't really want to drop it. And it's really kind of amazing to think of how much happened in that time. I mean, Bew during that time moved out, and he basically started his own life and got stuff going. I finished college. I moved to China. I ended up changing jobs twice, and we finished it before Moon Knight had to go in for brain surgery, but that was a big deal for him. He went through a whole lot of stuff too, and kind of the whole team. It's just, I mean, anything that goes on for 7 years, you're going to have a lot of stuff happen in the middle. I mean, that's 1 3/4 of a presidency in the U.S. It's enough time to go through middle school and high school.
Yeah, it's a big project. So, you've spent sort of a lot of time talking about ROM hacking and sort of with regards to translation, but I was actually kind of curious about what got you interested in translation itself as sort of its own thing. Was it specifically the ROM hacking and it just sort of snowballed, or was there something else that really...
I never really did the ROM hacking thing that much. I mean, today I've seen some, you know, let's be honest here. You look at most of the archives for stuff that people have done hacking on, and maybe like 1 in 900 are worth playing. I mean, back in those days, ROM hacking for the most part was, you were seeing stuff like people putting Mario in a wheelchair and things like that. I mean, it was, you get a chuckle and then you move on. I mean, it wasn't, I don't know, I didn't get anything out of that. So I had never really done any of that. The only reason I mentioned ROM hacking was kind of that's the lead up to what got people going in the translation direction at all. And as far as I know, there weren't a whole lot of people into this before I had got into it. It's certainly something no one really heard about much. I mean, you had the Oasis guys back in the early 90s who were doing patches, or not patches, I'm sorry, they were selling their stuff on disc. They were doing kind of crappy translations of a lot of old MSX discs. And like, with the MSX conventions and stuff, they were distributing their stuff. And then the next person that I've ever managed to find who was even doing it was Demi and SON2Freak. And Quatch and Lord Pinto, wherever they vanished into the ether. And then it was me. And then from that point on was when you had, boom, the whole translation scene caught out of it, because I started putting the page up, making updates, submitting updates to EMU News Service, which was big back then, and I think more people kind of saw, hey, this is cool. And there's all these games we never got to play. I mean, I grew up with Nintendo Power. You saw stuff in the back of that magazine coming soon all the time that never came. You had the Epic Center section, which showed, hey, here's all these cool games in Japan you're never going to get to play. And it was just something about being a 14-year-old and saying, fuck you, and wanting to do it. And copyrights be damned, and I'm a 14-year-old. My time isn't worth shit anyway. And so you do it. Yeah. Yeah, that's about all I can think of for that.
So I wanted to ask you how you moved into some of the other translation projects after Langrisser, or maybe, I guess, in the interim of Langrisser.
Yeah, it would be during really for the most part, because I haven't done a whole lot since that one got finished. really, it was kind of that same thing again. I mean, I know this kind of sounds like a little bit pompous or whatever, but I was, you know, I was looking at the time, it was still even, I mean, it's like, okay, in 1997, it made sense as for everything to be Super Nintendo, Nintendo, period. And I think by the time there were two Mega Drive projects by the year 2000, I think, it was the Langrisser 2 and there was Surging Aura, and someone might've worked on something else that never went anywhere. And two of those, they never got finished. Langrisser 2 did get kind of finished later on by Commander Stab and the Hiryu Honyaku team. But that's another story. They were kind of carrying on Alimony's work. I don't know. I was just kind of looking around, and it's like, man, there's got to be more out there than just Super Nintendo and Nintendo stuff, because the games are running the fuck out. I mean, I used to make a big joke about, you know, it's going to be so desperate for games that at some point someone's going to be start translating that Bazoo or whatever that goddamn game was. And son of a bitch, if it wasn't 7 years later, someone did translate that and release that one. I think they're down to like nothing but Traverse, Starlight, and Prairie, and one or two other ones, and they all... I mean, with the exception of like Romancing Saga 1 and 2, they're kind of really into the shit pit at this point. I mean, there's not a whole lot left. And so I was just kind of looking around and saying, there's got to be something else out here. So I started downloading big ROM sets and going through it and trying to find where is something else that's worth playing, because there's got to be something on other machines. And that's when I kind of found out, okay, there's a ton of stuff here out in PC land that no one's paying any attention to, and there's a ton of stuff on the old machines like PC 98, PC 88 that no one's paying attention to. And so I started working on those. And, you know, I released a couple partial patches. I never finished anything. That's... finishing stuff wasn't something I was very good at. I kind of drew attention to a lot of other platforms and got people to talk about how much I suck, and then, hey, you know, but in the end, it worked out. There's a lot of people who actually went through and finished those games. You can play the whole Farland series now. No one was even looking at that beforehand. And then kind of once... people started picking up and looking at that, and I kind of got bored screwing around with those. You know, I got tired of staring at vector.co.jp all day and downloading all the weird image extraction tools to try and figure out what the hell is inside these disks. And then I said, okay, well, what else can I look at? And it's kind of when I stumbled into Magna Carta, which you know very well.
Yes.
And my friend, a guy I'd met on some anime or IRC channel, he's from Korea. His dad had business in Korea all the time. And I still can't believe he gave it to me for free, but he actually got me a copy of the game. I mean, it was the real one.
Wow.
The box was missing. The box was missing, but I had the art book, the discs, everything else. And, wow, this was really, really damn nice of him. And so originally the idea had been that he was going to help out with translating. And I was like, well, this would be really cool. We can work on it together, and it's not too hard for me from the programming side of things. And, you know, he was talking about wanting to move back to Korea, and I said, you know, it'd be good. It gives you some reading material. You get some brush up on things, and... that's one of the things that I found out, because like when I was shopping around the Magna Carta stuff, when he fell through, I found out that like half the damn translation scene at the time were all Korean Americans, and not one of them was willing to translate Korean.
Yep.
And I'm sure you've had the same experience working on that game. And so that's why eventually it just said, okay, can't find a translator, I ain't going to learn Korean, and I put it aside. And at the time, I had switched over from Japanese in the university to Chinese, and that's when I kind of started exploring games with that. There were a whole lot of Wuxia games I played with, but the one that really kind of jumped out at me was Heroine Anthem, because the art and the style of the game and everything else was something that would be so easy for foreign audiences to pick up on and enjoy. In the years since now, you know, I've done a lot of different feature stories and stuff related to Chinese game history and gotten to interview some of the presidents of those old companies. And basically all of them kind of had this same opinion about their games, which is they said that the problem with Chinese games wasn't the quality of them. The problem with Chinese games... and I'm damn near quoting at this point, is that they're too Chinese. And
Too Chinese, what did they mean by that?
Well, okay, this is something that I found as a reoccurring theme living abroad now for 10 years in China, is that a lot of people here have a very hard time imagining that a foreigner could have any interest whatsoever in Chinese culture. I don't know why, but this is a really hard concept for people sometimes. And basically, their idea was that all of the stuff that Not all of them, but the overwhelming majority of Chinese games were set in a wuxia backdrop, which is where you've got, you know, the traveling swordsmen and all the Chinese monsters and, you know, there's this martial arts school fighting against this martial arts school, and the setting and the scenery and the dialogue and everything else is so quintessentially Chinese in every way. I mean, just, they couldn't imagine this adapting to anywhere else. And so the end result was the only place that they even tried to sell these games for the most part was in Korea. Because for some reason, China feels that Korea is close enough to China that they could accept this. And so I think several of the Kingformation games got sold over there. The only one that ever made it to Japan was the absolute most famous Chinese RPG, which was the Xianjian Qixia Zhuan. And that was you may have heard of it. They actually turned it into a TV series at this point, and the game series is like 5 games long. And hardcore gamers, I guess they played all of them, but damn near everybody who grew up in the 90s played the first one. I mean, if you were Chinese in the 90s and you had a computer, you played that game. And that was the only one to make it to Japan. It actually, when Sega Saturn went to Taiwan, they ported the game from PC to Sega Saturn. And the Sega Saturn port got translated to Japanese and sold on Sega Saturn in Japan as Senken Kikyoden. And that's the only one that got anywhere other than China and Korea.
Wow. So,
and it's not for lack of quality. I mean, this is the sad part, too, is that when I started getting into that on ROM Hack back in the time, there were a lot of, not a lot of, but I think there were like 2 or 3 people who were from Singapore and Indonesia and stuff. And I talked about wanting to work on Chinese games, and everyone's attitude was they immediately hammered it, like, why the fuck would you waste your time on that? This is shit. This is garbage. And, I mean, I was playing it, and this is a pretty well-put-together game, interesting story, good graphics, interesting combat system, a lot of fun. And they just, like, pound the crap out of it. I mean, and at the time, I didn't get it, but in retrospect, I kind of feel it's like when, you know, you've got the JRPG fans in the United States just beating the shit out of Diablo and any Baldur's Gate or anything else as garbage games because they don't match the JRPG model they like. And, I mean, I didn't get it at the time, but I think that's mostly what that was about.
Wow. That's very interesting. I guess I've experienced some of that with certain games, I would say Magna Carta to some degree, but
yeah. I don't know, a lot of people interested in that one.
Yeah, no, a lot of people are definitely interested in it, but a lot of the reason that I saw people being interested in it had more to do with the art style and the artwork than it was the game itself, so it was always hard to get people to actually play the game, not so much as sort of look at the promotional materials and stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, it didn't help matters that, I mean, I remember it was kind of flaky after Windows XP to try and run that at all, and being 3D, I'm not sure how it holds up in a virtual machine.
Yeah, it's it still works fine, but you do have to do some compatibility stuff, and there's a couple of little things you have to toy around with. So you can get it to work, but you gotta play with it for a little bit.
I had a friend working at Square Enix Beijing, and after the stories he told me about what he had to do all day long, I'm not shocked that so many games, especially the Japanese-made games and Korean-made games, have just nightmarish compatibility problems on newer systems. I mean, he said it was just 7 hours of his day was fixing the 1 hour worth of bugs that the Japanese team added the day before every day.
Wow. That sounds really rough. As far as, you know, sort of working on, you know, the Heroine Anthem games and those kinds of translations, do you see yourself doing more of those in the future, or are those something that have kind of passed since then, or what are your sort of prospects on those? Because I'm, you know, obviously maybe one of the only people who's still very interested in them, but there are quite a lot of people interested in them, so...
I kind of feel like I don't really need to work on that now because someone kind of picked up a lot of that. I handed everything over to a guy who, I guess, he had been working on it on the romhacking.net forum, and then they referred him to, oh, go find this asshole D, and he found me over at the Langrisser forum, and I said, oh, well, shit, man, you could have told me you were interested in that. All that stuff's been on GitHub for years. So, as far as I know, he's kind of just going along on that because the tools were basically done. I mean, they were tested. They did input, output, fine. There was no loss of data. All someone had to do was replace the traditional Chinese with English and insert the line breaks at the right space and click go and would have remade the whole game in English, no problem. But I don't have time for it now. I mean, I'm working way too much. I got two kids to take care of, and even the stuff with like Super Fighter Team, they had been hiring me for a bunch of different game hacking projects, and even then I had to say I can't do the programming part anymore after I did Star Odyssey and Beggar Prince and a bunch of the work on their Legend of Wukong game, and I just don't have time for it or the motivation anymore. There is one last thing I'd like to get out the door, and I've been procrastinating horribly on this, which was the translation of Guyframe.
I see.
Guyframe is like the, at least in the original timeline, would have been like the far end of the Langrisser series. It's set like 3,000 years after Langrisser 1, or after Crest of Gaia more specifically. And when I released Crest of Gaia as a translation, I think it would have been in 2003-ish. You'd have to check on that. I'm not sure. But I had put it on a big TurboGrafx-16 or PC Engine site at the time, and I ended up getting in contact through that with... Why am I blanking? Dave Shadoff, the major PC Engine programmer. He's involved in the HUC projects and a lot of other stuff. And I said, wouldn't it be cool if we did the other one too? And he said, yeah, that'd be cool. And I said, but I don't have time to do the programming. I can only, you know, work on the other side of it. He says, oh, no problem. And he knocked out a little C program to dump the script and send it my way. And, I remembered why I hated that Crest of Gaia game so much was the translating scripts that are entirely in hiragana is really, really kind of a pain in the butt. So it sat for a very, very long time until Darkness Savior offered to do that. And he finished up that script. It's still got to get edited, and the reason it's been in limbo forever is because I'm kind of trying to figure out how I want to treat it. One of the things I did when I was working on Crest of Gaia was there were a couple edits I made to the script to try and tie it a little closer to the Langrisser series, and I'd kind of like to be able to do the same treatment with Guyframe a bit. I'm not a really big person on literal translation and everything having to be exact, or, you know, if you can add a couple details that add a bit to the story or pull things together a little bit better, why the hell not? You've got information in your hands that they didn't have when they made the game because, you know, 10 years later they finished the rest of the series. And but figuring out how I want to arrange that and do that has kind of been a back burner type thing. Plus, I was really wanting to like rewrite all my tools for that in Python, and one of the old pieces that, man, I still haven't seen anyone make something to really replace it was that old FeiDN tool I made, which was the tile conversion thing to pull anything out to bitmap and send bitmap back to anything. And most of my workflow, one of the reasons I wrote that in PHP for whatever reason way back in the day, and it was convenient because at the time I was doing all the other translation stuff in PHP as well, so I could just include it, pull it in, and you know, it was just a one big script to run it all. And I just kind of felt dirty having like the script part now in Python and the graphic part in PHP, and I wanted to pull it all together, and I just haven't been that into working on that to finish it up. So it's been sitting in the corner of my hard disk for a while.
But you did, you know, as you said, make a lot of different tools for hacking and for compressing things and moving, you know, data around and stuff that a lot of people wouldn't have otherwise had and were very useful to, you know, to me and
probably to others. Sure, I'm up for that. I mean, we can talk. Well, I'd say probably two of the more interesting things were Fadian was definitely a pretty cool project. I guess there's the graveyard duck thing, which was really kind of funny how that one came about. What else did I work on? There's it never got released because it was stuff I developed for Super Fighter Team. But one thing was their Chinese games. I got the sense that a lot of that code was generated by compilers instead of by pure assembler because the pointers for a lot of stuff were just scattered everywhere in some of those games. I mean, it was really everywhere. There was, you know, mixed into all kinds of other event code and everything. I don't know how they programmed it that caused it to end up like that in the final game. And one of the little tricks that I had figured out was that the pointers in that game were all 32 bits, which was nice because statistically you got a fairly low chance of ending up having a kind of clash where you accidentally hit the wrong number because you're talking about 32 bits. That's a lot of bits. That's a big number. And so what I did was I had found the script, and the script was all in one place, but the pointers to the script to actually move anything around were all kind of missing. And so I said, well, what if we just do it backwards? And I wrote a program, simple little program, that would take the script, and it would go to where there's a stop point, move ahead one character, and then take that offset and try to find everywhere in the ROM that offset appeared. And print out a big list of them. So it was just like, you know, line after line after line after line. And if there were multiple ones, I put them together with a comma. Because what it turned out was, when you pulled that file open separately, what you had was the list of offsets where the pointers were located. So you'd use that, instead of dumping from a pointer list, you'd dump from a list that tells you where the pointers are, and then dump that pointer to get to the text. And the overlap ended up being so minimal. I think there were, out of, you know, several thousand lines, there were only maybe six that had a wrong pointer. And because you put them out in a little list like that where they were all comma separated, as soon as you pull that file open, you can eyeball and say, one of these things is not like the other. And then, you know, boom. It's like, obviously, okay, it's like, okay, here I'm looking at something that's in the neighborhood of hexadecimal 8,000, you know, 8,100, 8,200, 8,320. Well, obviously, 20 is not quite in the right spot because then, you know, the pattern continues after
that. Not quite.
And so, you know, you knock that out, and it turned out to be a pretty cool method to do that. I hadn't seen anyone do a game quite like that before. I just kind of remember people getting on the forum and bitching that there were no pointer tables or whatever. And I remember some old Super Nintendo games some people were really complaining about back in the day, saying that, oh, this will be hard to work on because there's no pointer table in here. And, man, I mean, even if it's 24 bits or 32 bits, that system, it seemed to work pretty good because what you're actually ending up hitting when you scan the ROM that way is you're hitting the event script. And event scripts tend to kind of be in order. So you can just kind of spot which one was the wrong one and knock it out of the list and keep going. And you only have to do that job once, because after that you got the pointer table list and you're good to go. And I think I used that on Wukong. I used that on Destiny of an Emperor 3. Hi, Gideon. Are you ever going to do Destiny of an Emperor 3? I gave you the tools for that back in 2006. It's not even on his project page. I don't think it's on the list anymore. It was like a sequel, not really a sequel, more like a remake of the old Destiny of an Emperor on Nintendo, but done in, you know, 16-bit graphics and kind of cartoony and kind of fun watching Liu Bei have limit breaks and shit like that. And the only problem was that they, as was the case in most of those games by Chuanpu Software, they stole most of the background music. That's why we never got further with doing Fengxian Yingjie Chuan or any of those other games, because the music was just so... I mean, you'd have to, like, rewrite everything or something if you wanted to release it for sale, which is what Super Fighter Team had been hoping back in the day. They might still get to it. I don't know, but... Because I think they picked up the rights to a lot of that when they did their big IP thing in Taiwan.
Is that a major problem in a lot of the Chinese games you've looked at?
Only the console ones. Only the console ones. It seems to actually just be the Sega Genesis games.
Interesting.
For whatever reason, that era just kind of... it was really wild. I mean, they wrote this whole original game from scratch. They coded all the original engines. I saw there was one of the guys who worked for that company had a webpage showing all the work they'd done on it, and you could see bits of the assembler code and everything. It's down now, but it was way back in the day, it was up. And, you got the guys doing graphics. The graphics were really good. I mean, looked like, Shining Force 2 quality work. And then you walk through the cave, and suddenly it's playing, like, Final Fantasy 2 music.
It's a bit of a problem.
I don't get how you got the budget for making such a kick-ass game and having such good art for it, and your music is like that. Maybe they spent all the money on those parts and then realized that they just had to steal the music.
Yeah, maybe. Hard to say.
Let's see, what else? Well, the Fadian thing, that came about because of an ongoing problem, which is that every tile editor that has ever been made sucks. And I haven't checked in a couple years. Maybe someone's finally made the Miracle Program. But as far as I'd seen, every tile editor ever made sucks. If it wasn't a multiple of 8 pixels wide and ordered perfectly in a row and, met exactly the standard Super Nintendo way of storing 16-color graphics, or the Nintendo way of 8-color graphics, or the Mega Drive way of 16-color graphics, you're shit out of luck. Then none of them could open anything. There was TMod, which was kind of cool. It was a DOS program back in the day. It was built back in the day to be like an extensible kind of editor. People could write some plugins for it. And as far as I know, Dave Shadoff he's the only guy who ever wrote a plugin for it. He wrote ones for the PC Engine 16-color format, which is deceptively similar to the Super Nintendo 16-color format, but the bit ordering is different, so the palettes will be all jacked up if you use a Super Nintendo tile editor. And there's a sprite format that they actually had 16-color sprites. It was 16 by 16 and 16 colors, and no one supported this. Because the thing is, they didn't divide it into tiles. This was actually a 16 by 16 tile. The bits just ran all the way across. And so he wrote something for that. But, man, for other things, like, when you had fonts where you, say, for example, Langrisser, it was really funny because the first byte would be like if you're talking like an XY axis, it would be like 0 to 8, 0, 0 to 0, 8. And then byte number 2 would be like, what would that be? Going down, that would be 0-1 to 8-1. And then the next byte would be split in half, because the third byte would appear finishing out the 12 the 12 dots at the top row and the bottom row. Well, there's no way in hell to see this in anything that exists. You had to write something custom. And for a long time, that's what a lot of people were doing. It's like every time they wanted to do a game, they wrote a custom program just to dump the damn font. And that's just stupid. I mean, it shouldn't be that hard because, to my way of thinking, it was keeping a lot of people who, you know, there's a lot of games that don't need that much technical work, frankly. I mean, there's a lot of ways you can go about stuff. And people who probably could have gotten by with a lot of other standard tools like Atlas and all these other kinds of things, they were basically being kept out of the game because there was no way to even touch the font for them. And so that's why I had created Faedion, because it was like, if you can at least see the pattern with your eyes, then you can get at it, even if you don't know how to program, was the idea. Because if you open it, like, say, for example, you had, Neil Corlett. He had a really nice little program he wrote for DOS that was just a viewer called Nana. And you could go to, you know, monochrome or two-color linear, two-color planar, however you want to arrange the bytes, and just, you know, stretch it. How many columns wide do you want it to be? And often enough, if you go down to, like, you know, 8 columns wide or 16 columns wide and look at it, you can spot what's going on here, where are the dots going. And once you figure out where the dots are going, you can kind of draw where they should be. And that was the idea behind Faedion. And if you can use your eyeballs like that, then you just type it out where the dots should be. And I tried to make it as easy as possible, and I think I might have made it too easy, because the only people I've met who really figured out how to use that program were the ones I showed how to use that program. And once I showed them, they were like, oh my God, this is the best thing ever. It was all Chris RPG used until he died. Not saying that Faedion killed him. That was another situation. But, I mean, he was really big on it. I mean, even though he and I had a big fight, he can recognize a good piece of software, and he was really, you know, one of my loyal users, even though we weren't talking to each other. So that was cool, because I at least got some feedback and stuff to improve. And the idea was just to try and make it like a Swiss Army knife for any damn thing you could want to do to a tile. And over the years, I patched some other stuff onto it. Like when I got to the Chinese games, I found not just the Chinese-made games, but even some Japanese games. They were all using actually the same damn font. There was probably some different toolkits back in the day that people were using that they pulled in the font they needed. And it just kind of stuck in, you know, on demand. It assembled something using the tiles that would be needed to match up to what they're writing. And, you know, it's really a bitch when you dump that font and you look at it and you see there's 2,000 characters on the screen here, and they're all drawn really shitty because it's usually 12 by 12 or 16 by 16 or something. They're awful fucking resolution. And why make it so difficult, really, where you got to reinvent the wheel every time? And the idea was with one of the things I added was, way back in the day, a lot of people were like, oh man, optical character recognition is going to be the savior of ROM hacking. I mean, we can just put that graphic in and it'll spit out a table for us. Well, the fact is that pixel fonts are usually drawn so goddamn bad that optical character recognition doesn't do shit. But the thing is, the binary is good, because if they're using the same thing in multiple games, they're going to be the same bits. And so what I came up with was the Faedion would take the tile and shrink it down as much as possible by trimming all the black space until there was nothing but ones and zeros there. And it would hash that and store the hash into a table, and it would go through the font and hash everything. And you'd have like an associative thing where it says, okay, this hash means it should be this character. And then you give it your input font, and it would go through and hash everything and see if it has any matching hashes. At the time, you'd have to give it an input table plus an input font, and then the font you want to scan, and it would make an output table. If I were smart and I wanted to do this again and I wanted to make like a really cool web utility, I'd crowdsource it. You know, let people upload their font plus the table, and it would go into a database. So when people get a new font out of a game, they just have to upload it, and you check the whole freaking database to see if any of the hashes match, and spit out a table back to them, where now instead of having to ID 2,000 characters, he's only got ID, you know, 6, 10, whatever. But again, I don't really have time to write this at the moment, but it would be a really kick-ass idea if anyone else wants to do it. And hey, with Fadian being in PHP, this should be really fucking simple to integrate into a web app.
Yeah, no, definitely.
So it was just kind of things like that. And then we had some other stuff was like, okay, well, you know, not everyone has the skills necessary to do, you know, a simple ASM hack to do, like, even 16 by 16 fonts to 8 by 16. So it was popular for a while was doing, like, a dual tile hack where you just scan the English script for letter pairs and write the letter pairs over top of the Japanese and then match the letter pairs up to the what's in the English script. A lot of early stuff was done this way. So I figured, well, let's make it easy for people. And there was one program you'd run that would scan your whole script, and it would spit out all the letter pairs. And then you take the letter pairs plus your font, give it to Fadian, and it would spit back out a bitmap that has all these pairs already made that you could insert back into the game. And then all you'd have to do is program, you know, whatever's converting your text back to binary to just, you know, take letter pairs one by one and match them to your letter pair list as far as which numbers should be which. It was just kind of that kind of project. It was looking at a lot of the problems that everyone was having and trying to figure out how can we make this easy, how can we make this where people don't have to constantly be looking for some kind of, you know, programming guru to save their ass all the time. Because the more people who can work on stuff, the more stuff's going to get done. There's always going to be some new kid with a whole lot of energy and a whole lot of passion. And it's best if he can burn that passion as fast as possible, because every time he hits a wall, it's going to slow him down. And the Graveyard Duck one, yeah, run through that really quick. Graveyard Duck was, it came about because Kitsune Sniper was working on some game. Can't remember. Oh, no, it wasn't him. It was Gil Galad. He was working on the Famicom disc version of Castlevania 2, and he had found the font, but it was a total fucking mess. I mean, it was obviously compressed, and he couldn't figure out how. And being that it's a Famicom disc system game, you could get each piece out in parts, you know. You didn't have it was like you can dump the sectors out, and usually stuff lines up to the sectors. And so he had just the font sitting there, and I looked at it, and I said, okay, here's the font.
We're getting some major breakup.
So, so I'll just start over with the Graveyard Duck thing, then, because that's not too far back, right? Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Cool. So Graveyard Duck was, it's obviously, if you don't get the reference, it was named for the Get a Bag from the Graveyard Duck line in Castlevania 2. Because what happened was Gil Galad was working on a translation of the Famicom Disk System version. He's kind of been into Famicom Disk System stuff for a while. And he was found the font in the game. He had been dumping the sectors off the disk, and he pulled the font out, but he could not figure out how the hell this thing was stored. It was obviously compressed somehow. And it didn't look like it was too bad. So I had asked him for, grab a screenshot, or a, not a screenshot, a save state of the game with the font on the screen, and, pulled that out with Fadian and did, like, a little comparison between the two, and It kind of just jumped out because, I mean, you could see what was going on pretty simple. It was a really simple RLE system they were using where it was basically, they just used the sign byte or the sign bit at the top of the number. If it was unsigned, you went this way and said, okay, then, you know, you write out however many, the next number is 5. You write the next bit byte 5 times, and then if it's the other direction, then you write the next x bytes. Sorry, keep screwing up there. And so we put it together, and it worked. And then it turned out to be pretty cool. And I went to Kitsune Sniper, and I let him know. I said, "Hey, this is we threw this together really quick." And he said, for Castlevania 2? And he says, I showed him the picture, and he says, that's Konami crack. And I was like, what? He says, apparently for like a lot of years, no one was touching a lot of old Nintendo Konami games because the fonts were always so jacked up, I guess. And he said that apparently this was being called Konami crack or whatever, and it turned out to just be one of the most piss-simple RLE routines I've ever seen because there was no debugger or anything. I just looked at the PEX editor and figured it out. But so we put the tool out, threw it out there, and you know, we tested input output a bunch of times, and everything was golden, no errors. And sure enough, as soon as that hit romhacking.net, there were all kinds of people screaming about it, how, oh, this isn't the right way to do it, and this doesn't really work because he didn't do it with a debugger and actually check what the assembler is doing. And man, because, you know, people got to have something to bitch about. And, He's right. It wasn't perfect because there was one case that I missed, and apparently the code had this thing where if you hit this one specific byte, I can't remember which, it's in the comments, I don't even know if I ever bothered to implement it because it could never fucking happen. Basically, it was an edge case saying that, you know, you hit something like 256 bytes in a row where no freaking compression was possible. Now you can use this magic byte to skip ahead or whatever. And, dude, when you're dealing with CHR graphics, especially something that's black and white like a font, there's always going to be a spot that you can compress. That's just a given. So, I mean, not a single game ever actually encountered this, even if it was in the routine. I mean, because I had Kitsune test this with Rampart and all kinds of other games, and all of them compressed. And they went out perfect. They went in perfect. And even changing the font, everything went in perfect. The only way this could ever happen, I mean, it was really like an edge case. And so that's how that one got thrown together. And I don't know, I just I tried to do a lot of simple things over the years. I was working on a library for a while called LibPirate that's probably been lost from the internet now. But I had this really crazy function that was like a universal resource unpacker where it took like 10 different parameters, but if you gave it all the parameters right, it would actually write the code necessary to execute that and throw it inside of an execute line to turn it into, you know, it would turn itself into real code or whatever and then provide you with the unpacker. Because I found that, you know, half the games when I was doing with whether it was Wind Thunder or games by that the guy who did Akuji and Guardian of Paradise, I think his name was Buster. They're all so similar. Even like the Langrisser CD versions, the way they store their stuff, it's a basic resource format. When I was working on Sentimental Graffiti 2, Interchannel, it was just another resource package or format. And I found that I was writing the same thing, just with a few variations again and again and again. So I wanted to write something that would just, you know, do it for me. I was getting kind of sick of it.
So, out of curiosity, what are some of the projects that you would like to see completed?
Among my arsenal of unfinished stuff? Right. Well, personally, I want to finish up the Guy Frame translation. That's kind of been nagging at me for a long time. I really want to get that one done and over with. I'm really hoping to see someone finish up Heroin Anthem. That would be pretty cool. I don't have the time for it anymore. If they ever release that third game in the series, maybe I'd kind of be motivated to go after it again. I heard they were finally working on it again, actually.
Yeah, no, I actually saw some news about it very briefly, but
yeah,
I haven't heard much since.
Well, what had happened was with Wind Thunder, they had been like a subsidiary. I think they were, what was it? Was it TGI? I can't remember. It was another software label. They did a couple games under them, one of which was the Guardian Sword series, which was also pretty cool, very similar artwork. And then they did Heroin Anthem and Heroin Anthem 2. And what happened was, Heroin Anthem 2 happened to come out right at the time of the great Taiwanese game crash. Basically, it got to the point where so many people were making RPGs because somehow people got the idea that this was a way to get money or something, and everyone just kind of pounced on it and churned out, like, literally hundreds of crappy Chinese RPGs within a year. I mean, you'd have, like, still the old hands who'd been in the industry for a while are making good games, but it was getting lost in this avalanche of shit coming out from everybody else. And between that and the piracy situation and the Taiwanese courts, which were extremely unkind to game developers, they basically, I don't know if it's a Confucian thing or what, but they kind of looked down on them like, you guys are just entertainers. You're not doing anything really important, so fuck you. We're not going to let you enforce your copyrights or anything else. And so no one ever managed to recoup anything. But anyway, all the companies, unless you were a major player who already had their hand in online RPGs, which were the next big moneymaker, you got screwed. And Wind Thunder was one of the ones who got caught up in that. And from about 05 until, I want to say, 2013, 2014, the company basically only existed as an outsourcing studio. They were doing character designs for Japanese companies. They were doing video work for Japanese companies. They were doing animation work for Japanese companies. And so a whole lot of different studios, a lot of the Chinese game studios ended up turning into these outsourcing outposts where all the Japanese companies would send their work after they, you know, cut their budgets, fire half their animators, send it to China. You know, it was the same story that's done in the U.S. Yeah. And that's so... apparently, they've done well enough in that or something that they were finally able to say, let's finally finish this series, and I don't know where that's going right now. Hmm. And aside from those two, I can't really think of anything I'd like to really want to work on. Bu and I had a project for a while that we never managed to finish up, and it was called Open Shiren. And there was a... are you familiar with the Shiren the Wanderer series? Sometimes,
yes. Very,
yeah, it's the
very
mystery.
Yeah, mystery dungeon. Fushigi, no dungeon.
Yeah. Anyway, they had a Windows version of it, and I had gotten that a long, long time ago. It was a CD one. And then I missed it until it popped up on Vector one day. And are you familiar with Vector?
I am not familiar with Vector.
Do you want to sideline and hear an interesting bit of history on how all the big Japanese software sites came about?
Of course.
Okay. Since we have no direction whatsoever here, let's go for it. Vector was actually a bulletin board system from way back in the days of dial-up bulletin boards. I actually still have, from doing the Langrisser site, I've managed to recover a significant amount of files that were circulated related to Langrisser on dial-up bulletin boards back in the 1990s. Like, I think there was a MDX audio set someone did that was posted on the RAMG BBS, and I had to do a whole lot of sleuthing around 2chan to figure out that, this was actually, I think it was a Kanto area BBS, and anyway, Vector came about the same way. It was a BBS where everyone would go on, upload their software, a huge shareware archive, and when dial-up bulletin boards went in the toilet, they made the leap to the World Wide Web, and that's what started the Vector Archive, which is around today. And actually, if you are into, I don't think that's very well known, but if you are into PC-98 emulation or X68000 emulation, they have a shitload of software for those old machines. I mean, you can get alternate operating systems and massive amounts of tool sets, ports of all the GNU utilities to a lot of that stuff, and that's all still hosted on their servers. You got to kind of go down this dark tunnel to even figure out what section, you know, still has that on their site. But to this day, they still have a lot of those files from the early 90s. Yeah, sure, and the Wanderer. Okay, so I was on I was on that site, and I had seen that Chunsoft had just put out an updated version, which was an internet-enabled version. And I'm thinking, how the fuck is Shuren going to work as a multiplayer thing? Because, I mean, Mystery Dungeon multiplayer, that doesn't really make a lot of sense. What do? You take a step and wait for the other 2,000 players who are connected to also take a step? I mean, and that wasn't what it was. What it was they had taken the score ranking from the game, and they put it online. Where when you died or exited the dungeon or whatever, it would send up your score with your name, and there was a picture showing, you know, what shield and sword you had and however you died or whatever, and it went into a big ranking list to see who could get the highest score. And that wasn't the only thing that they had done in there, though, because the registration system was also hitting the same server. And so I had pulled open Ethereal, which eventually turned into Wireshark, and started trapping some of the packets going back and forth. And when I hit, you know, I saw the packet go out to the Shuren server, and I see it come back, and it was just an HTML web page that said failed. You know, it was like H1 tag failed. And I thought, huh. So I opened my host file, I redirected it to localhost, I had a little web server there, and all it did was it served a page that said, okay. And wouldn't you know, that's the way they were authenticating accounts. So we sat down and we figured out like all the other different little event things, and we actually wrote our own clone of the server that could do, you know, let you recover your password, change your password, create an account on the machine, authenticate your serial number, whatever bullshit serial number you make up. We make sure no one else was using it and say, okay, we recognize you by that. And then we started collecting data. And the way we did that basically was you'd play the game, and when you died, you'd type exactly what happened. You know, because it let you send a message with you when you died. And we'd say something like, I died on floor 5 carrying this sword and this shield, and I was killed by this monster, and I had this much gold and this much health and this much food, and you know, my belly was this full or whatever. And you'd get back this gigantic string. It was had to have been in the neighborhood of like 60 bytes long or something. And we started chopping it up and trying to figure out what's what. And it didn't take that long until we had probably about 97% of this string figured out, where we could figure out exactly how you died in the game, what happened, what kind of food you had, everything else that was coming out of that. And we said, well, you know, we should just make our own server, because anyone can go download the freeware game, you edit your host file to hit our server instead of their server, and then you can, you know, because actually what was really funny is if I put the authentication part on my own machine but left the score posting part pointing to their machine, the result was it would authenticate to my server, and they didn't double-check it on their end, so I was sending totally bullshit high scores to their server for a couple days. So we were playing with that for a little while, and then Bill and I were talking, and I said, but you know what doesn't make sense is... the game's still all in Japanese, and no one's really going to play it because the Japanese players are all playing on that machine. And so Bu sat down and he banged out a little program that would replace the strings in RAM, and we never did anything with it. It's still on GitHub. I got it if anyone's interested in working with me on this. But there's the whole script sitting there in text, and all you have to do is change the text, and it'll insert that into the game when you run it through our launcher. And the launcher also lets you change which server you want to connect to, so we can build a new server or whatever. And you could actually do this in any language. All you'd have to do is take that file and keep translating it to more languages, and you could have, you know, a language-free international Shuren server or whatever that anyone could hop on and play. But... yeah, it was just one of those ones that never went anywhere because no one likes translating Mystery Dungeon games, I guess. And it doesn't help that you know, all the NPCs all talk like hillbillies, which makes it a nightmare to translate if you come from, you know, an academic Japanese background, like if you learned in college, and that's, they talk pretty funky. I mean, if someday someone wants to work on that, that would be pretty cool to get it up and running again. But the downside is now with Windows changing so much, I don't even know how long that's going to be good for until we hit the point where you'd have to play through a virtual machine.
Yeah. Well, I don't have a whole lot more questions or anything. I'm kind of curious about if there's anything that maybe I should have asked you that I didn't ask you. Something you wanted to talk about.
Well, let me think. Probably some of the only other thing I could think about that probably no one else has a lot to say about is the getting paid to translate games or getting paid to hack games side of things.
So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't have a problem with it because, I mean, as long as the company is paying you, has the rights to do it. That was, Super Fighter Team, they've been going around and they started with the Chinese games and then they started picking up some Japanese stuff like Blue Almanac, which got released to Star Odyssey and stuff. And the reality is, as you quite well know, the source code never stays around. The source code is lost immediately. It's like, oh, well, this game's out the door. Let's take all the art and all the source code and everything else and throw it in the damn garbage. And
yes,
we'll never need that again. It's out the door.
Sadly, very aware of that.
And then, they say, oh, let's do an anniversary edition of Final Fantasy. By the way, how did the items work and what items were there and how was battle math calculated? Yes, we have to bring in a Nintendo packer. You got to hire someone to reverse engineer their own damn game for them so they can do the remake. But that was basically the tiny hole that I fell into there was that they, you know, there's not a whole lot of people who do that kind of stuff and who will also not leak it and who are been around for a while, I guess, where they're trusted enough. And so in 2003, that's kind of when I started a relationship with those guys. And Super Fighter Team has a long history with C&E Entertainment. They're a Taiwan game maker, and they did a couple console games, quite a few PC games, I think. Their console games that are probably the two best are the... Oh, how did I translate that to English before? It'd be something like, Legend of the Holy Flame or whatever. It's an RPG. It's a little bit slow, but it was kind of their first attempt. And then the other one that was really cool was their Function Bomb game, which is, honestly, I'd have to say, I put that in my top four NES RPGs.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's right up there with Dragon Warrior 4. It was a fantastic fucking game. Only Nintendo game I've seen where you got like full screen bosses, kind of like Gulliver Boy on the PC Engine, and long, really well made, great enemy art, good music. It was a fun little game. I was really, really happy playing that one. And it's basically, it just kind of loosely follows the story of Function Bang, which is the overthrow of the corrupt Shang Dynasty by the Duke of Zhou and whatever. You play as Noja, who's he's a god figure in Taoism, and also just kind of like a folk mythology character. And you pick up some of the other popular characters in Chinese mythology along the way, like Arlong Shen and Zhang Ziya and some of the other guys like that, and go on the quest to beat the evil king and his fox spirit concubine. And They did a good job of tapping into stuff from the story and using it for the game. Like, you know, you're walking all over the world map forever, but eventually you got to get, like, you know, the flying form of transportation. And, Final Fantasy had the airships. Dragon Quest usually had, you were either some kind of bird or a flying carpet or whatever. And this one, you actually had to go beat the shit out of the Monkey King and steal his cloud. So you'd be riding around on a cloud near the end of the game, which is pretty cute. They pulled all the stuff together really well. And even like when the Dragon King kills Sinoja and he has to go down into hell, and you've got to beat your way past all the different guardians of hell so you can reincarnate and come out under Master Burning Lamp and whoever else. And it was really, it's an excellent game, and I really wish to hell someone would work on that one. And it's just whoever does it, it's going to be a heck of a lot of work, because the way it was programmed is really weird. I've never seen a game programmed the same way, which is that they have this massive character ROM that stores, you know, because you can only load a certain amount of, you know, pages into the memory on the Nintendo or whatever. And so literally, they've got like, I want to say 20 to 40 different fonts in the game, because each one only has 256 tiles in it, which with 16 by 16 text gives you 64 characters. So the result is, it's kind of, it, like when a dialogue box comes up, they look at the characters in the dialogue box and figure out which of the fonts in the game will match this dialogue box. So then you've got to go get that set and load it in and use whatever matches out of those 64 characters. So there's a massive amount of repeats, too, because, you know, really common characters appear in every one of the different blocks. And it would just be a real lot of busy work. Someone will have a bit of a headache for the first couple of days putting that together. But, yeah, that would be a really cool one to see done. I really hope someone works on that one day. Otherwise, I can't really think of a whole lot. I mean, it seems, man, you've got to think about this. If I started doing this in 96, and Demi and SOM2 Freak were that same year, then that means the translation scene has kind of been at this for 19 years now.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, they've done a shitload of games. There's not a whole lot of good games still hiding out there. I mean, there's some mediocre and okay games, but they're kind of out on the obscure systems. Like, it's not that good of a game, but it's kind of an interesting game on the PC-88 called Fangs, the Saga of Wolfblood. And the reason it's interesting is it was one of the last games with... I remember reading that the enemy sprites were designed by the same guy who actually drew the in-game sprites in the old Dragon Warrior games for Enix, like the first one or two game.
Oh, wow.
You know, you could say that Toriyama, he did all the concept artwork and stuff that was the guidance for a lot of that, but the guy who was actually the sprite artist who made everything happen in the game, he also worked on that game, because Fangs was also another Enix game. Enix, before they got moved into mostly the console territory, they were predominantly a PC developer. In fact, one of the oldest Enix games you're going to find is probably, what was it? I think it's Lolita House, where you have to randomly pick keys and stuff and to save a prepubescent girl from a table that's got a circular saw dropping on you. And, of course, as you expect in a Japanese game, you're rewarded by her taking her clothes off. Which, hey, I mean, dark times, man. I mean, I remember that's why
dark
even
time.
In the... Even in the mid-90s, you talk about PC stuff with people in Japan, and no one owned a PC because the reputation was like only perverts or business people own PCs.
Wow. It's different from now, I guess.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that's... I had a pen pal from elementary school. She and I kept in touch for a lot of years, and I had write something about computer stuff, and they're just always, you know, no one owned a computer over there. It was kind of unusual. You had to really be into it. The only other thing, I don't know, I'll probably find a lot of new stuff, because what I'm working on right now is trying to do a lot of the really early Chinese game history, because they just celebrated, I think they were declaring that it had been, what was it, the 20th anniversary or 25th anniversary of Chinese games. They wrote a bunch of articles a few years ago. But the thing is, from like 1983 to about 1987-ish, damn near everything is lost. No one seems to have actual copies of any of these games anymore. Not even, like, pirate copies, which is really kind of weird to me.
Wow.
There's a Chinese game. The English name, it's usually listed under as, MX-151 for the Apple II. And that's one, as far as I know, that's, like, the second oldest known game. And one of the only ones from that time where they actually still have a copy of it. And part of that's to do with, like, a lot of the disc naming projects. Those guys have never really given a toss about Unicode. I mean, when I was doing a lot of the stuff with the Langrisser site, I found out that, you know, the Elfleet series, Elfleet, Crest of Gaia, Guyframe, they were all released on PCs in the mid-80s. And I couldn't find any of it. Couldn't find the MSX version, couldn't find anything. Well, the reason I couldn't find it is because when you check an MSX archive for Elfleet, even though it says Elfleet spelled out in Latin letters on the title screen, it was indexed as Elcid. E-L-C-I-D, as in the Spanish national hero. And, you know, lots of other stuff like that, where they make up their own, you know, fucking even, was it, it was either Beggar Prince or Final Fantasy Magic Knight, which for some reason is always called by other goof names. That's the, I think it's been called Barber, Battle Soldier, and all kinds of other weird shit. But the actual, the Chinese name literally says Final Fantasy the Magic Knight, because the Outer Space Soldier was the old Taiwan way of writing Final Fantasy. It wasn't until Final Fantasy came to the Chinese mainland that they actually created a name that actually says Final Fantasy. And the box, there was a Japanese collector years back who actually had it with the packaging, and the box art was just like pilfered Akira Yoshitaka Amano artwork. And but that one, for reasons unknown to me, well, this part isn't unknown to me, but the Mega Drive games, they have a header block in it where you can store the name, you know, usually as a string and some other data about the game. And for some reason, in that block, they had typed in Breath of Fire 3. And sure enough, it was indexed for many, many years as Breath of Fire 3 for Sega Genesis. So the game had fuck all to do with Breath of Fire. Like, Fire. Title screen says something completely different. In fact, there's even English on the title screen, but they indexed it as Breath of Fire 3. It was either that one or Beggar Prince. I can't remember. One of them has Breath of Fire 3 on the internals.
That is something else.
So, I mean, yeah, Unicode and stuff like that. And, I mean, you check the Nintendo games, it's even worse because you'll have... It's like they just grab whoever. You know, they hopped on IRC and says, hey, who reads Moon Runes? And, you know, what does this say? And they you'd have, like, you know, the Chinese... This game's named in Hanyupin from, you know, like, it's named in Mandarin, and this one's named in Cantonese-style pronunciation, and this one's named in... Man, I don't know. It sounds like it could be fucking Hakka or something. I don't know. Some other crazy dialect. Like, they were just making it up as they went. And then some would be in Pinyin, some would be in Wade Giles, and there was no consistency, and it just makes it a nightmare to find anything. Not to mention, since no one gives a toss about Unicode, you can't even search for the Chinese to begin with. Japanese games have the same problem, but it's a little less severe because there's more standard romanization and you're not dealing with so many different dialects, I guess, or at least such radically different dialects. The thing that we didn't talk about was that Ninja project, which ended up dying. The old patching format I'd made.
Oh, yeah. It's the universal patcher.
Well, I mean, it was a good idea, and it was a bad idea in other ways. It was a bad idea in that it was like that damn XKCD thing of, you know, everything else sucks, we should make a new standard, and the solution is now there's 13 standards instead of 12 standards. And I really don't like that I contributed to that problem, and it was probably too ambitious because basically it required that anyone who was going to try and implement this actually rewrite all the same stuff I wrote in another programming language, which was just, you know, that's ludicrous. You can't expect people to sit down and do that. So that's why no one else ever managed to implement it. I think there were two quote-unquote Ninja-compatible patchers, but the only one they worked with was the one that said, just make the patch. Don't worry about what format it's in, which kind of defeats the whole fucking point of having it in the first place. You know, the idea was that, you know, no matter what format routes are in, they'd always work, because the perennial headache has always been... Maybe it's better now with no intro. I don't know. I'm kind of out of the loop on that. But, you know, you'd have this one has a header. This one doesn't have a header. This one's interleaved. This one's not interleaved. This one shouldn't be interleaved, but someone interleaved it and screwed this up because low-round games are never interleaved or whatever. I mean, they were all crazy, all kinds of crazy things that would screw up your patching process depending on where someone got their ROM from. And so, you know, I had like a, basically the idea was whatever games came in, it would convert it to a base format. Like, you know, Super Nintendo comes in, okay, let's de-interleave the shit out of this until we're sure it's right, and then make the patch. And then when someone applied it, you de-interleave everything, make sure it's right, apply the patch that way, boom, no problem, nothing's going to be screwed up. If it doesn't work, it means you got the entirely wrong ROM version. Same with Sega Genesis. There were all kinds of the old SMD early format. And, I think there was a same problem with the N64 ROMs. You had, what was it, the V64 and Z64 ROMs. One was interleaved, one's not. And Nintendo, you've got, oh my god, you've got Pasifami format, you've got Internet. You've got UNIF format. You've got, what is it? Someone wanted to do that XRIF format. There's all these different stupid formats. That one's that whole platform is just a nightmarish loaded gun to work with. And so the idea was basically to take the guesswork out of that, because anyone who's released a patch has, or at least in the last decade, released a patch. Got a million goddamn support emails saying, I'm trying to patch it and it's not working, this isn't working, this isn't working, and you've got to try and figure out, how do I tell the guy he's got the wrong ROM or needs to do this to his ROM and then apply the patch without sending him the ROM myself, because I don't want to support piracy, even though I'm releasing things that cause people to download pirate software. and then, you know...
Strange irony.
It's the drama behind it is really, in a way, I miss it in the sense it's nostalgic, and at the same time, it's the most churning waste of time imaginable. I mean, I remember releasing this thing, and romhacking.net just exploded with fucking angry people. Like, Nightcrawler was out there, how dare he tell me I have to store my games in this way? If I want interleaved games, I'll have interleaved games, god damn you. Your tool shouldn't de-interleave my games without my permission. Just pages and pages of stuff like this, man. People going out of the woodwork saying, this is terrible. You can't tell me how to store my collection. I am one of the 10 people who have a copier for this platform. And I need my games in this format. Well, if you got a copier, probably you got a tool to turn them into that format in the first place. Isn't it worth the time saving to, you know, take all the headache out of patching a game so that, you know, everybody can do this, because there's a lot more people who don't own copiers than you. So, and, but, I mean, there were a lot of mistakes in the format. It was really limited in what it could do. I mean, theoretically, it could, you know, you could have, like, a freaking patch a file that's a zettabyte in size, but it didn't deal with things like, you know, sliding data, which at the time when I was making this, it hadn't really become an issue yet. We were mostly dealing with, you know, PlayStation games. If you had a PC game, you might have some data that did that. Like if you did anything in a resource editor, that kind of moves a lot of stuff around. But, I mean, in retrospect, I mean, yeah, that's a major, major issue. Bu had tried to solve that with his, what was it, Beep. I think he had a patching format called Beat before all that got pulled off his website. And that did like X Delta type sliding stuff very, very well. And it turned out that as time went on, you know, Nintendo DS games came out, and apparently from the Brazilian people who have contacted me over ICQ asking me to update my stuff, this has become a serious issue now because so much data gets moved around when they rebuild that NDS thing, because the NDS image, I guess, is like a self-enclosed file system where you can move stuff around. And so that's something they're dealing with now. But, yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of stuff over the years, I guess. I regret that I didn't get more of the games done that I started working on, but at the same time, I have other things to do in my life, and there's other people who will pick up the project if it's good enough.
Yep, I could not agree more with you on that point.
You're going through that with Magna Carta, are you?
Yes, sadly, I have been on and off with different translators trying to sort of get people to work on it, and then I'll get people to send me a couple of lines of something that's translated, but it's, you know, it's not translated correctly, or it's translated in sort of gobbledygook that would be hard to understand as English, much less as any other language. And so I've sort of been going back and forth for a long time with translators, trying to find just sort of people that I could actually work with that would be willing to stick around for a long period of time while files get edited and sent back and forth and, you know, sort of move through that editing process. And that seems to be the, I sadly have not been able to find a Korean to English translator that will sort of stick around long enough. So, and I decided that I wasn't going to sort of work with patchwork of files that all had different sort of translators translating different things as a sort of,
yeah,
you know, to create.
Hey, you asked me earlier if there was one other thing that I wish I'd have finished, and that would have to be now, you know, it took me until now to actually go pull open my little, you know, files.derek.sobadash.com thing and look at my translations to see what I had done or what I hadn't finished. And I remember we were working on Xianxian. I really wish we had finished that game, because it's still the most famous Chinese game ever. And I mean, it's like, you know, my wife grew up with that game. I played the hell out of that game, and I really wish we'd finished that one. But we got the demo out. There's you can play like the first hour or two. We had released that. Actually, I think. Yeah, you can actually still get that on my website. I got it on there. It's a 260 meg file. But we were doing that in 2005. And at that time, I was working at the Oakland Press, and kind of like in between writing news stories, I'd be editing dialogue and working on that. And I moved to China when I graduated, and what happened was everybody involved with the project graduated at the same time. I graduated. Jackie, who was doing a lot of the programming, graduated. The Google guy, who was one of the other programmers, he graduated. And everybody went to work. I mean, I was teaching university for a year, and I was teaching three full writing classes where I was grading 60 papers a week, trying to do lesson planning, having, you know, it's your first year. Whenever you do something the first time, and education, you work your ass off because you're making lesson plans on the fly. And I had no time to work on it anymore. Jackie, he ended up working with I can't say that, he wouldn't be happy, but he got a job with a major game development company that swallowed all the remaining time of his life. And the other guy just kind of wandered off, too, because both of us were gone. And it's a shame, because the part we did was really good. I mean, we did a pretty decent job trying to translate the humor into English good, and, you know, writing, you know, all the Chinese poetry was a nightmare, so we'd actually take the Chinese poem, translate it literally, and then try to write an English-style poem to stand in for it. And, yeah, the part we did really good. That was another thing I was doing on my desk at the newspaper. And it's not like I could read the internet. They had me on an iMac running OS 8.6 or something. So, and yeah, I mean that one. I really wish we'd finished, but I don't know. Everyone's gone such different directions and is so busy with their own stuff. I know we're never going to come back together to work on that. I thought I saw someone was working on this one a couple of years ago, but I don't know whatever happened to them. They kind of vanished into the ether too. But that's yeah. If you ask ones that I wish I would have finished, that's kind of a big black hole. I wish we'd have done that. 97 was really like the birth of the translation scene. I mean, that's when you had Sidra working on the Fire Pro Wrestling thing. You had the dozen freaking groups all competing to try and do Final Fantasy III. That's how Nightcrawler ended up involved in the scene. He was in one of those. And a couple of the other groups, I think, go back to that time. There's a few that pop back up. I can't remember if it's some... oh, gosh. Not, was it Magic Destiny or one of the other groups? They kind of they were gone for, like, I want to say, like, 11 years. And then somehow they just kind of came back here in the last couple years and have been finishing up a lot of their old projects. So that's really cool to see that, you know, there's people who still care that much coming around and trying to clean house on stuff they left unfinished back then.
Well, I do think that the one good thing is I have seen, at the very least, a lot of good work come out of a lot of new people, so that's made me very happy
over
the years.
Sorry. Oh, there's who am I thinking of? Not Nijet, I worked with him, but wasn't there a guy who was posting on romhacking.net with the handle Steve Martin or something like that?
Yes.
Oh, no, he was...
At one
or it was like him and Pennywise or something. They were doing Mega Drive stuff, and their work was fantastic. Those guys are really doing a great job, and I'm just, even to this day, I'm glad whenever I see, you know, translations getting done on systems that really don't get any love. There's so much out there that, you know. The best on those systems is better than the worst on the mainstream systems. Otherwise, you're going to just keep seeing it as a race to the bottom. I mean, there's been really some goofy stuff people have been translating the last couple of years. I mean, and the sad part is, man, a lot of those games that have kind of come out now, even some of the ones that were in progress way back then, are really, man, you know, you play it and... You know why it never got finished, or you know why it never came out. No, seriously, I mean...
No, I'm not...
I'm banned for life from the Fantasy Anime forums for reasons I cannot remember anymore. Apparently they all remember why, but won't tell me. That goes back years, but every, like, you know, maybe once a year or something, I swing by there. And they have their little retro gaming sub forum or whatever, and it's gotten to the point where, like, even Ametrius, who was like the cheerleader of all the translation groups and stuff, even he, I saw a post coming in from him. It's like, it's really cool that it's done, but honestly, I couldn't play this one more than 2 hours. There's been, yeah, it's, I mean. I know there's a lot of good games out there still, and I'm hoping to hell that more people find them. And as long as people keep finding them, the scene will go on, because there's definitely new people coming in, and it's great to see that there's so many people taking an interest in Nintendo DS and stuff. I've never even held a DS. I'm an old man. I the last machine I owned was a Dreamcast. So, oh, wow. I mean, all this new stuff is, you know, this is all newfangled stuff to me. I don't know anything about those new games, but that's the stuff they're growing up with, and that's the stuff they're going to have an interest in doing, and it's awesome that they're doing it, because for years, everyone was kind of trying to rope everyone into saying, oh, CD systems are too hard, don't work on those, you should cut your teeth on a Nintendo game, and you're looking, like, guys, there's no fucking Nintendo games worth doing left anymore, why are you directing them to this? But, so, I mean, that's really what it was. I mean, you look at when I got in 96, and 97 and stuff, we were growing up. The Super Nintendo was still getting new games. PlayStation was just coming out at that time. We were doing the stuff that we felt like we missed. And that's why we were so passionate about it. You can't have a new kid coming in who grew up with the PlayStation era or the Dreamcast or PlayStation 2 era and tell him, oh no, those are too hard. You should come work on the old man games from my generation. I mean, that's
yep,
it's stupid. They're not going to really be it. Yeah, I mean, they're not passionate about it. I mean, every now and then you see some really fucked up kid who's into retro gaming for whatever reason, but I mean... For the most part, keep the laughter on this when you edit it. That's really good. Otherwise, I'm just going to come off sounding like an asshole. But I mean, really, okay, you know, there's classics everyone will always love, like Pac-Man and stuff. But I mean, you take a kid who's growing up on, you know, the games from the 2000s, and you sit him down in front of, you know, some grinding-ass game like Dragon Warrior 1 or 1 to 4, they're not going to have the patience for that. That's like, intolerable. I mean, think about all the games where half the menu options just told you can't do that, and you had to pick another one. I mean, that's all been streamlined now. No one has the patience for that. And truth be told, having worked on Saturn stuff, having, you know, worked on Dreamcast stuff, that's another one that I never managed to get out the door. I was working on Hanabumi Taisen Columns 2, which is a Sakura Wars game that was based on Columns, where, like, they'd have their dialogue and fight. You'd play Columns against each other or whatever. And I kind of worked on it because it was simple enough to do. The translation stuff was so short. And that game had a really cool system. The script format in the Sakura Wars games, they actually had a control code that would go after each syllable so that the control code would tell the game engine which mouth thing to load. That way, as the script is printing out onto the screen, the mouth moved in a way that kind of made sense. They'd actually have like a vowel indicator after each kanji and stuff to say which, you know, how the mouth should be moving to match up with this. That was really, really interesting. I've never seen another game do that. What ended up happening was, you know, Dreamcast was super easy to hack on. You just burned a new game, stuck it in, boom, go to town. And somehow I ended up running up against a memory allocation error that I asked around for like 6 months, and no one in the Dreamcast development scene could help me get through that. And well, that one went in the toilet, never to be seen again. I still have a few screenshots of the error. And Sentimental Graffiti, I translated about, what, probably in the neighborhood of like 600K of the game script, and which is a lot, man. That's almost like the size of their Langrisser. This was a bad time in my life. I was, you know, isolated. Most of the people I knew had gone to other cities for college. I was home alone, and what did I do with my time? Study Japanese, play dating sim games. So it's not a very proud time in my life. But so I was working on translating Sentimental Graffiti, and I had finally gotten to the point where, like, you know, I actually had to dump the game myself by having the Dreamcast hooked up over Ethernet. And, like, I would boot the Dreamcast over Ethernet, swap the disk in, and then read the disk over the hub to another computer, dumping, you know, just reading the GD-ROM start to end, which was the only way to get it off, because they're a GD-ROM. And, the scene releases back to that time, they gutted the sound and the music and everything else, so it was like, why am I even playing this? And so I had so much of that script translated, and I was moving it from one hard disk to an error to another on a Windows 2000 box. And there was a this was the mistake. I didn't copy and paste. I cut and paste. And there was an error I have never seen before, since, heard on the internet. I don't even know how this happened. But just suddenly it told me the hard disk has become detached. All data being transferred has been lost.
Wow. And that's it.
Yeah, I mean, after, like, you know, you put probably translation-wise somewhere in the neighborhood of over 100 hours of work, you know, a couple hundred hours of work probably into this, and you're like, okay, I just, you know, I know my machine's kind of shaky. I want to get it off the old hard disk and onto the new hard disk. I cut, paste, start moving it over, and boom. And I just kind of stared at it for a few minutes, just slack-jawed. Can't believe how the hell this happened. And I think I went from there to opening a bottle of Captain Morgan's.
Nice.
Yeah, that's it. Oh, what else are you going to do in that?
Yeah.
So, I mean, after putting that much work into it, I just never even wanted to look at it again. I was so sick of that. I mean, that was really upsetting.
I'd imagine.
I've never seen that error before or since, or ever heard of that error happening before. I was just blown away. I'm sitting there frantically searching the internet. Is there something, can I recover this somehow if I don't click OK on the dialog box? Because that was the only thing. It gave you a notice and said, click OK. There was no cancel. There was no abort, retry, fail. Just boom, the data was gone as soon as you did cut. That was a shocker. But yeah, I mean, so yeah, it's great seeing seeing more kids working on stuff, and that's what's gonna keep it going from generation to generation. And you know, I don't know how many of the old people are still hanging around, or how many are even working on anything. From what I know, it sounds like the only people who've been around a long time at this point is like Gideon and. Nightcrawler is still kind of around, but and Bew is around. He's from, I think he goes back to 97-ish. And aside from that, I don't know who's still hanging around anymore from the old days. Probably everyone's in the same situation. They got a job, eat all their time, got a wife, got kids, and no one wants to screw around with this right now. But then maybe, who knows, maybe in a couple of years it'll end up all of us start coming back. I mean, if those guys from whatever it was, Magic Destiny or whatever, if they're coming back and working on stuff, maybe we'll all end up coming back and working on stuff.
Yeah, who knows? It's hard to say what's going to happen.
It is, yeah. I even, Nightwolf, he's been doing some stuff again. Actually, I think he's working on Emerald Dragon, which is it's great to see someone working on that one. I wish they were working on the FM Towns version, but hey, at least it's not. Hey, it's the PC Engine one. It's the next best thing.
Yeah.
So that's great to see, because they really, the Super Nintendo one made some really big changes to try and make it, I don't know, it was like they wanted it to look like Final Fantasy. Gave it this ugly-ass washed-out palette and redrew it all with tiny sprites and world maps and transitions that, you know, none of this existed before. It's like a different game.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that's cool. He's back into it. He keeps taunting me over Facebook saying that, you know, you'll come back eventually. Everyone comes back eventually.
Never get to escape, huh?
I think a long time ago I kind of said something to the effect that ROM hacking is like the Hotel California. You can never leave. But,
Well,
He looks like he's pretty much moved on. I think he passed off all his Shell Monster stuff to some other people who finished that up. And I've definitely... I mean, I got a couple things I'd like to pick at if I get time, but it's, I got so many things I want to pick at. I mean, I was working on Guy Frame, and I probably would have finished that in like 2013. And then I got turned on to Arduino stuff and was working with DF Robot making some shields for old sound chips. And I got sitting next to me on my desk right here, our half-finished acoustic musical instrument that was, we were working on an acoustic instrument where instead of vibrating strings, we'd have vibrating floppy disks going into the, going into it. It's kind of half finished. Then my friend moved to Shanghai and that sat here ever since collecting dust and getting me yelled at about wasting space in the house. Hey, this would be an interesting topic. I'd love to know how many people from have died over the years during ROM hacking.
Because
it's up to at least like 10 people who have either died or faked their own death and did a damn good job of faking it.
A little morbid. But what why do you want to know, or why are you interested? I mean, I couldn't actually tell you.
It's
anything like that, but
it's well, you know, it's kind of the morbid curiosity of getting on Facebook and every couple of years finding out someone else from my graduating class dead. You know, it's consider it an interest in your own mortality or whatever. You know, when the people start dying, you feel, you know, that's part of getting old too, I guess, but. I remember, this is probably something that you probably wouldn't want to put on your podcast, but it's interesting to have on record nonetheless. ROM hackers seem to have had really, really bad luck with car accidents over the years. And Nightcrawler can probably tell you more about that, but I believe there's like in the neighborhood of like people who were critically injured by car accidents or actually killed by car accidents. I think there's actually been two who died from car accidents and seven or so people seriously injured.
Wow.
Just in the community. Actually, I don't remember if this is correct or not, but Lena Chen, who took over RPGE, I want to say it was in the late 90s or early 2000s when she was working on that. I remember someone actually sent me her obituary from Puerto Rico.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. Someone shared like the obituary for her on the IRC channel way back then. That's why she vanished.
Wow.
And then you've got Chris RPG, who passed away of AIDS. And, I mean, there's a lot of people, I think, who have actually died over the years from this little community. Well, not from the community. People from the community. People from the community who have passed away over the years, not people who were killed by the community.
The RHDN is haunted.
As far as I know, no one has been killed by the community, but they're
hopefully.
As far as I know, I mean, there's probably been a couple people who came close, but as far as I know, that's not happened. But there's definitely been a few people pass away over the years.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot can happen in 20 years. So.
Yeah, I mean, almost 20. Yeah, it's 19 right now. Going to be. Definitely a full 20 years from next December, at least since I got involved in it, and probably SOM 2 Freak and Demi, they were in mid-96-ish, I think, was when they started all that. So yeah, it was like the 20th anniversary of the translation scene should really be like summer 2016. It's amazing that, I mean, I'm always impressed that stuff's still going on, you know, there's still new people coming in and still some of the old people hanging around. It's a long, long time. And for me, it's even more staggering to think, well, I mean, frankly, I've been away from it since, you know, I don't think anyone even indexed it on RHDN or whatever, but I did an updated version of my old Guy Frame patch like 2 years ago that got silently pushed out. And, but aside from that, I've basically been away from it since Daryl Angresser, aside from writing a couple tools and helping out some people. But if I had been in it the whole time, that would be really freaky to think that, like, two-thirds of my life at this point were involved in game translation. That would be really crazy. Though we did do the math when we finished up Daryl Angresser. It turned out that we, at that time, it had been like 1 in 4 days in our life was spent working on Daryl Angresser. That was kind of upsetting. There's so much over the years. Honestly, the first catastrophic event for the ROM hacking scene that most people probably don't even know happened was the death of Square Planet. That, when probably you say that today and everyone would be like, what the fuck is Square Planet? There was a... Yeah, you had no idea, right? Yeah, I'm sure. That's way too early. Back in the day, there wasn't a whole lot of places you could go to put a website. You had GeoCities, which would give you 10 megs and cap the fuck out of your bandwidth, so you couldn't really put anything on there. And then you had, Dragonfire had already gone pay from 96 onward. You had to pay.
I very much remember GeoCities, or as everybody called
Dragon, it. Dragonfire is an interesting project. That was hosted by Andy Church, who was going to Carnegie Mellon, and it was literally, he just had a computer jacked into the Carnegie Mellon server that he was hosting people on for fun. And then he eventually started charging for it and moved it to a collocation box, and that's when you had to pay money. I kind of hung on a little bit through that. But there really wasn't a whole lot of options for hosting back to that time. I mean, you had what? There was Tripod. There was
Lycos, maybe? I don't even know.
Did Lycos host Pages? Lycos, I thought, was just a search engine. You had Tripod, you had Angel Fire, and GeoCities. And so, like, a lot of the people were hosting their stuff on those three. And suddenly this site, Square Planet, came up. I think it was squareplanet.net. Don't look for it in archive.org, because archive.org is fucking worthless for anything before 99. And it was only around for probably the span of like 6 months. But in this span of 6 months, somehow every freaking person who was involved in translation scene stuff moved onto those servers. It was like if you had in your portfolio a single Square game or Enix game, they were like, we'll give you space. And everyone moved there. I don't remember what happened with it. If Squaresoft did something to them and shut it down, or if they had technical issues and shut down, or what. But they went down with no warning whatsoever, and immediately, more than half the translation sites went dark overnight. And most of them didn't come back. I think DJAP might have been hosted on there for a little while back when Jedi was running it, way before Dark Force was involved in that, I think. And then, I can't even remember all the other ones. There were just so many. I mean, if you look at some of the old sites like EMU News Service or some of the really old pages on patent pending, you see them up every now and then on Google if you're searching for really old shit. The site Patent Pending comes up all the time. And I don't know how they're structuring that site, but somehow they just have, like, all these ancient pages kicking around inside their archives that go back to, I mean, stuff that hasn't been updated since 96, 97, 98. And you can find this, like, graveyard of groups there. Of people who used to be around, and man, half of them went down the Square Planet, and so much trauma back then. There was that. There was the fight over the Final Fantasy III translation thing. That Nightcrawler was a big part with that one, and so many fights back to that time. It was really. The scene is really, like, mature and doing good today by comparison. I don't know if it's just, like, the quality of kids is better, or because they all grew up with the internet, and, you know, they're part of the Facebook generation, and they're not so used to the anonymity of the wild and early web, but people I mean, they're still dicks to each other, but there's not nearly that degree of drama.
I think it's just people have gotten used to what it offers and what it can't offer.
Yeah. Back to that time, oh my god, everyone was... Those were some really, really crazy days. the early internet was a very different place from the internet today. Yes,
the early internet was a very different place, I definitely agree.
You know, I kind of miss those days, though, of like, you know, today you search for something and don't find it on Google, and you think to yourself, I must have structured my search wrong or my query terms are no good. Back in those days, you'd get on web crawler, you'd type it in, and if it didn't come up, it didn't exist on the internet.
Yeah. No, it
didn't. Or at least if it did, you wasn't anywhere you're going to find it.
Yeah. I would say that way of thinking has also very much changed as well. Most people believe that it can be found. It's just a question of asking the right questions.
Yeah, back to that time, there's a lot of shit where it's just like, no, nobody parked it there yet.
Yeah.
There's still a lot of stuff that's not on the internet yet. I mean,
you'd be quite surprised at how much stuff I would say is probably not on the internet. At least,
well, I mean, even
at least not findable through Google or other, you know.
Well, even back to, I mean, talking about, like, my childhood period, the stuff with the bulletin board systems, man, that's like a forgotten era. No one knows anything about that anymore.
Yeah.
You've got Jason Scott's got textfiles.com, which is a fantastic resource. Everyone should go and read that at some point just to understand what computing used to be like. But, he does a good job of capturing text files from that time, but as far as if you even wanted to know what boards existed or what was big at a certain time and stuff, a lot of the resources for that is all gone. The messages from FidoNet, as far as I know, have never really been archived that much, except for some of the later things. FidoNet was...
Derek, you're starting to break up again.
No, anyway, I'll wrap up here really quick, but just... For this is off topic, but for you, I mean, you being into all kinds of historical research type stuff, FidoNet was an amazing communication tool that was probably in effect for most of the 80s and their first half of the 90s. And that was basically the BBS version of email. What you'd do is you'd have your FidoNet account and you could send messages to other people, but it wasn't like email where the message instantly went out. You'd leave a message and the person could get it the next day because all the bulletin board systems would automatically call other bulletin board systems and they'd call other bulletin board systems and everyone swapped messages. And anyway, that all the messages from that, there's virtually nothing that survived. But, yeah, I mean, as far as, like, the content and messages, it's Usenet. You know the story behind why there's still a copy of, or I'm sorry, yeah, Usenet. You know why there's still a copy of Usenet, right?
No.
There was a university in Canada, I can't remember which one specifically, who had been, since the dawn of Usenet, recording backups on tape. And the university was cleaning out their storage room. They had all these tapes of Usenet data that they were going to throw in the fucking garbage until someone called Google and said, do you guys want this? And they put all the tapes in a car and drove it off to Google, and Google integrated it into Google Groups. That's the only reason most of the early Usenet stuff survived, if it hadn't been for that one backup.
Wow.
I mean, data, I mean, yeah, you working archiving, you know data is some fragile, fragile shit. The only thing that makes data survive is you got to put it in as many places as possible and forget about it. Don't curate it, leave it there, and let the next archaeologist deal with it. Yeah, it's really, 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 really tough. But, well, yeah, I think that's about it, and I think if there's anything else I would say, it just would be really cool to hear from more people who, you know, might have been around back then or that I talked to, because you kind of lose track of everyone. I ran into Dave from RPG over LinkedIn, actually, because I remembered his name. You know, it was the early days. We knew each other by a first name, you know, our actual names instead of knowing each other's handles.
Yeah.
And, so I knew his name. I found him, and I looked at it. I said, oh, that kind of, the college part reminds me of him, and the age is about right. And it turned out that I had another games reporter who had him as a contact, and I managed to get, like, an introduction through them. It took, you know, him a year to respond or whatever, but turned out that, yeah, it was him. I had the right guy, and it was just, you know, cool to catch up and find out he's, you know, doing, like, indie game stuff now out on the West Coast. And, you know, it's I think there's, like, a certain degree of closure that you get. You know, it's like the end of the story. You find out where these people you were fighting with or, you know, friends with or fighting with or frenemies or whatever, where they ended up. And it's a cool feeling to find out what happened to everybody.
See back around the ring.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you kind of want the curtain call that says, like, you know, come out and take a bow and say, yes, I was asshole 007 back in the day or whatever, you know.
The thing
that you find getting older, especially like when you're pushing into the mid 30s and stuff, is you look back on all those battles with fuckers not getting me the patch on time, and why didn't so and so send me this translation stuff tonight, and oh my god, how are we going to get the game out the door, and this other group is fucking with me, and boy, I hate this guy. And but you look back on all that when you're older, and it's like, man, that was a great time. It really was. And as you get older, look back on it, it's like, man, that was awesome. You can only do that when you're a kid, but yeah. I mean, it's awesome. I have a lot of great memories of a lot of people I remember as bad people. And I'm sure they have the same feelings about
the appropriate rivals.
I'm sure there's a lot of people who have the same feelings about me too. So it's we all got to be part of each other's lives for a couple years.
Yeah. Well, like I said, thanks again. May ask some more questions or send some more, like, just blips your way if there's something I need clarity on or anything like that.
Yeah, if you got anything else, just, you know, let me know. You can make up a little list and maybe we get in touch, like, you know, later this week or something.
Yeah, no, that sounds good.
Okay, I'll let you to it then.
Yeah, thank you. I'll talk to you later. Thanks again.
Thank you too. It was a lot of fun.